Okay, let's give our main speaker a big South County welcome to one of our own, Bo C. from Avila Beach.
Oh boy. I'm an alcoholic, my name's Bo. My sobriety date is July 23rd, 1999. My home group is the Melody Men's Stag. It's on Friday nights at 8 p.m. It's a closed meeting, meaning you must identify as an alcoholic. And it's a men's stag, which means you must identify as a male. I have a sponsor. That's not even funny. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And I have sponsees who have sponsees. Some of them are here tonight. They're going to fact check me. I'm going to share with you tonight in a general way what it was like, what it used to be, what it happened, and what it's like now. I'm going to share in a general way, which means I'm going to pretend my mother-in-law is in the audience. I'm serious. So what it was like. I was never this nervous then. You know, what can I tell you what it was like? It was miserable. I mean, it was awesome for about 10 minutes. For about 10 minutes, it was really cool. I started drinking at about 13. I grew up in a Navy family, meaning we never lived anywhere longer than 2 or 3 years. I never had that core group of friends. And everywhere I went, I was trying to fit in, and I never fit in. Sounds like you guys have heard that before this evening, huh? But that's the way it was. I mean, I didn't have, you know, by the time I was 11 years old, I had a little incident happen in my life with a bully. And at 11 years old, I realized that I was all alone. It was just me. That I couldn't count on anybody else. And, you know, at 9, I had the world figured out. I had it all. And by 11, I realized it was just me. And unfortunately, I didn't discover alcohol for about another 5 years. But I did. I discovered alcohol. We had moved to Washington, D.C. from the Philippines by that time. And my dad's in the Navy, my mom's going to school for her profession at that time, and all my friends are starting to drink. And my mom knows this, and she doesn't want me to go out drinking with a bunch of kids. So she says, what do you want to drink one night? And I said, Boone's Farm, because that's what all the cool kids drink, right? And she said, what's Boone's Farm? And I said, I don't know, apple and grape. I don't know why I said two different flavors for two different bottles, you know? It's just Providence. But she brought it home and she said, you know, drink at home tonight. And, I drank one of them. I don't know which one. And I remember that second bottle was in the fridge and I had a pretty good buzz. And I knew that if I didn't drink that second bottle, it wasn't going to be there in the morning. I wasn't going to get this opportunity again. So I remember sitting at the sink, at the kitchen sink while my parents are asleep upstairs, kind of forcing myself to finish that second bottle. I didn't get sick. There wasn't any great white light. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, this is the answer. But it planted the seed. Right around 11 or 12, I got this thing in my head. It was called the You Suck voice. It just showed up one day. I was right here. And guess what it said? Every chance it got. It told me how bad I suck. Every day, all the time. You suck, you suck, you suck. And that's the way it was. You know, I did not do well in school. I was always told that I had potential, and I was very careful not to use that potential. Because if I used that potential, I wouldn't have anything, right? So I'm going to keep the potential. It's what I've got. So I was very careful not to use that potential. I did not like school. It bored me. And I didn't fit in, and there were bullies. And so I discovered alcohol. By the time I'm 15, we moved to New York City, and I leave home. And I go to the Lower East Side of Manhattan and shave my head. It's about 1981. We're trying to figure out what punk rock is all about. I would go to the CBGB hardcore matinee every Sunday, listen to bands like Black Flag. Having no idea what they would be now, you know. And I had a funny haircut, And I was running down the back street screaming, oi, 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 and I was fighting the yoke of white middle class oppression, you know? Mom, Dad, you know? But yeah, that was it. And I started drinking. Back then in New York City, the drinking age was tall enough to reach the counter. And I found that I could sit at the subway station at Cooper Union and bum subway tokens. And subway tokens back then were, I think, 65 cents. And if you're a young kid asking for a subway token, you could usually get a couple of those off of people. And they were legal tender. And a quart of Bud, they had not invented 40s yet. But a quart of Budweiser was like a $1.50 or something. So you get enough subway tokens, you go into the nearest bodega, you buy a couple quarts of Bud and drink a couple quarts of Bud. All my buddies were sniffing glue. I tried that, and it did nothing for the you suck voice. It just, you suck. You know? I kind of felt like glue was what happens when all the brain cells die at the exact same time. It wasn't my thing, but the alcohol was my thing, you know? Drugs are kind of a part of my story. I mean, drugs weren't so great because they also, you know, I always had the you suck voice. That it, you know, some drugs made it go really fast. You suck, you suck, you suck, you suck, you suck, you suck. And you smoke that stuff and it'd be like, bro, you suck. You know? But I drank alcohol and it went away. And it was just gone. And there was that, you know, perfect moment where nothing else exists. You know, all those things that people say to me that are sharp came at me, but I didn't care. And that was the beauty of alcohol for me. That's what it was like, is alcohol gave me, I don't care. And that's all I wanted, was I don't care how bad I suck. And so let's fast forward. I'm New York City years later. I'm still drinking. I'm working in nightclubs. I mean, I did a lot of stuff, and I did a lot of stuff drunk. I did have a brief period of sobriety because I had to pass some tests and go to this school and do this thing. And I was actually able to quit drinking at one point somewhere in there. You know, it's all kind of a blur. The 90s, the late 80s and 90s are all sort of a blur. So somewhere in there I had some sobriety, but it wasn't sobriety. I just wasn't drinking. I kind of knew I was an alcoholic from the get-go, and I didn't care. I thought it was fine. I felt that I was a functioning alcoholic. My mom had also taught me one time when we were in Germany how to maintain what she called a mild euphoria. And that was, you know, always have a little bit of beer. You know, just maintain a buzz. And I was a long-distance runner. I could drink all day long. You know, I had friends who were sprinters. They'd drink fast. They'd throw up. They'd pass out. I thought, you know, what's the fun in that? But I would just be really, really drunk. There was no mild euphoria about it. I was blackout drunk for as long as I could. And then, so I'm in New York City, and I get in some trouble with the wrong people. I come out here to California because I'm running away from that. I figure I'll, you know, clean start. I bring a hostage with me. We got married for 11 months and 2 days. It took me 10 years of sobriety to realize that she was not a bad person. She was actually a really great person who married an alcoholic. And that was a big realization. It took me 10 years, right? Sometimes slowly, sometimes very slowly. So, I don't know how I'm going to go 45 minutes, but I'm going to try. So here I am in California, and I'm drunk in Alameda. I settled in Oakland because, like New York, it was a big city, but it seemed like a really nice little big city, you know? It was very clean. They had trees and stuff. You know, Oakland seemed like a really nice place, and this is probably 1992. And I had read, I was a big Bukowski fan, and I read that Bukowski wrote that if you're drunk, you become a shipping and receiving clerk, because that's a job you can do drunk. And so I did that. I called up Barnes & Noble. They needed a shipping and receiving clerk. I went to work shipping and receiving drunk. And it worked fine for me for, I don't know, a couple years, 3 years, 4 years. And that's sort of my pattern of employment, is I would get a job, make myself indispensable. I'd work really hard at it because I knew that at some point I was going to slip. You know, at some point I was going to screw it up. But I knew that if I made myself somewhat indispensable, that I could slip up for longer without getting fired. And that worked for a while with that job. And of course, at one point, they got rid of me. So now I'm in Oakland. I got no job. I'm living in a cruddy little apartment. And you suck voice is just hammering at me. That's what it was like. I'll tell you last thing about what it was like. I'll tell you about my best day of drinking. My best day of drinking was I walked down from my cruddy little slum apartment in the flats of Oakland to the Rite Aid. And I had some money in my pocket. I wasn't sure how much. I either had 11 bucks or I had 6 bucks. I was not sure whether that was a 10 or a 5. And I wasn't going to check. I don't know why, but I remember that. And I walk into the Rite Aid and I get a bottle of vodka, the big plastic one, a pop-off that you can drop when you're drunk and it won't break. And I get the big bottle of Carlo Rossi Chablis, the green bottle, right? Because those go great together, right? One for morning, one for evening. Makes sense to me, right? I mean, you want to shut down the You Suck voice? That'll do the trick. And I'm in line, and I don't know if I have enough money for one or both of them, but I know that I need them, and I need them both. And what made this the best night of drinking ever is I'm sitting in line, and the dude in front of me is looking at the checker, and I'm sort of looking, and all of a sudden, he just out of nowhere, bam, pops the checker. The checker hits the back of the wall, hits the ground. I walk out with the booze. Best day ever. Right? We laugh about this. Best day ever. That's pathetic. That's as good as it got, you know? That was Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, rolled up into one, you know? Two bottles of crappy booze. And that's as good as it got. Shortly thereafter, I'm sitting on a tricycle. It had streamers. And I had just finished a bag of wine. It was previously a box of wine. You could take the bag out. I don't need to tell you guys this, right? You can put it in your shed. You know this stuff. So I drank this bag of wine. And I think I probably drank a couple 40s of Mickey's. I have a Mickey's tattoo. I was not sober when I got it. Neither was my buddy James, who got the exact same one. And he's sober now, too, by the way. So I'm sitting on this tricycle in Piedmont, and I'm just super drunk. I'm just wasted. And the You Suck voice hammers in on me. It's right there. It's telling me how bad I suck. And I know I'm drunk because I can barely sit on this tricycle, you know? But there's the You Suck voice. And it's not quieted. I can't find oblivion. And I don't know what to do. And I'll never forget that moment. And in that moment, I think, what do I do now? And I was like, I got it. A bullet. That's what I do now. Because that's all there is. The idea of quitting drinking had never occurred to me. You know, to stop drinking, that would, you know, I'm going to stop breathing tomorrow. You know, no. Drinking was such a part of my identity and who I was and what I did that, you know, an attractive woman could walk in a room and she could be attractive. And if I found out she didn't drink, she was no longer attractive. You know, if I was talking to somebody who I thought, you know, might make a good friend and I found out they didn't drink, they scared the heck out of me. And I didn't want to be friends with them. You know, I was a drinker. That was what I did. And the idea of me not drinking, not possible. So I got the You Suck voice. I'm wasted. And I have the answer too. And luckily at home, I've got something to fix that, right? And so I'll just fast forward through all the gory details. I actually kept the pistol clear taped to a mirror so I knew where it was when the time came, which sounds really like creepy and morbid. Looking back on it, it's so alcoholic. So like, you know, it's just so us. And so on a Friday morning, July 23rd, 1999, I wake up, I'm in my room, I'm in the corner, and I have this pistol on my lap, and I wake up, and it's sort of morning, and the pistol's cocked, it's loaded, and it's covered with drool, which leads me to believe that it probably spent some time in my mouth the night before. And I have this sudden realization in that moment that the drunk guy tried to kill me last night. The drunk guy took the pistol off the mirror, cocked it, loaded it, cocked it, put it in his mouth, and the drunk guy was going to kill me last night. And if I get drunk tonight, the drunk guy's going to do the job. He's not going to make the same mistake twice. And in that moment, I didn't want to die. So I went over the telephone, which I kept unplugged. I kept it unplugged because if you have a big plastic bottle of vodka and your phone is unplugged, then nobody calling, then nobody's calling you. Nobody who loves you matters. You know, none of that exists if the phone is unplugged and you have the big bottle of vodka. And I kept all the mail under the couch, because as long as you got the big bottle of vodka and the mail under the couch, none of those letters matter. You know, they just don't matter. I don't care. That's what alcohol gave me. So I plug the phone in and I pick up an envelope that about a week before, maybe 2 weeks before, a woman leaving my apartment had been yelling at me, and I couldn't really understand what she was saying, but she was like, blah, 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 AA, blah, 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 blah. Threw the envelope down on the unplugged telephone, walked out the door, never saw her again. So I knew about this A&A thing, right? And I only knew it because I knew this chick who was in a band. They were called the Seven Karma Fishes. She didn't drink, and she went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just thought that was just mind-blowing. But I knew that it existed, right? I had no idea what you guys did. But I pick up the telephone, and I call that number. It's in Oakland, and this guy answers the phone. And I'm like, hey, I didn't even know what I said. Hey, I think I got to go to a thing. Because I have no idea what you guys do. Like, do you go to church? Do you, how does this work? He's like, cool, where do you live? And I'm like, no, I'm not telling this dude where I live. So I tell him the ghetto apartments across the street from my ghetto apartments, right? I don't want them coming over, I may decide I don't want to go, but... So I call it, and he tells me how to get to a meeting. He's like, are you driving? I'm like, no, I got a skateboard. He's like, so he tells me the nearest meeting, and it's at like 11 or 12 o'clock that day. It's at Central Office, and I leave my ghetto apartment. I skate over to 2910 Telegraph, and I walk up the staircase. It looks a lot like the old Melody, actually, and it's their inner group. And I get to the top of the stairs, and as I'm going up the stairs, like, I don't particularly believe in God or anything. But I remember thinking to myself, hey, man, I'm going to do this A&A thing because I don't want to die. And I'm going to sell the pencils at the airport, which is what you guys are going to make me do. I'm probably going to have to get on my knees at something like that. And I'm going to get on my knees, and I'll get with the Jeebus or whatever, whatever God you guys have. I know it's a religion, right? But I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this because I don't want to die. So I walk into the room, and I remember the last thing I thought was, just please don't make it suck. There's always that caveat. So I go into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me a while to figure out, because I didn't know then, obviously, but they're reading out of this book. It's called a 12-12 something, right? And I remember it went around the room, came to me. They ask if anybody was in their first, second, or third day of sobriety, or their first 30 days, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, my name's Bo. And they all turned to me and they said hi, and they clapped. And I was like, wow, I couldn't believe that I just said that. Much less that people were acknowledging me and almost seemed stoked that I was an alcoholic, So we go around the room, we read from this book. I can't tell you what I read, I have no idea. I read. They passed a basket, and I knew it, right? But only had $1, and I didn't buy coffee, and coffee was I think 50 cents, so I put the dollar in the basket. I'm like, that's my last dollar, so I don't know how I'm going to afford to go to AA now. But but then the coffee lady, she brings me a cup of coffee, and I'm like, I don't have the money. She's like, it's okay, hon. And she gives me a cup of coffee. And that was kindness, It was just such a small act, but I'll never forget it. And then we get up after this meeting's done, and we all stand in this circle, and we hold hands, which I thought was super hinky and weird. But we're holding hands, and then we say this Christian prayer. And my dad's a priest, right? So he's a naval chaplain, so I know this Christian prayer. And I'm like, okay. And then when we're done, dude next to me turns, gives me a hug, and says, keep coming back. And like the hug was kind of, I didn't really know how to handle that. But it was kind of wonderful, And the keep coming back, nobody had been telling me to keep coming back for a long time, It's like, don't let the door hit you on your way out, I mean, literally that week I'd been scouting out bridges in Berkeley to live under, because I figured if I lived under a bridge in Oakland, my life expectancy would be much shorter than a bridge in Berkeley, Berkeley's a nicer town, theoretically. And now I got this guy telling me to keep coming back. And so I do. So the next day I call central office. I call that number again. I pick up that envelope. I call that number. Same dude answers the phone. Tells me where a meeting is. He, you know, and I tell him, yeah, I live, and I give him the address of the place across the street. He tells me where the meeting is, right? And I go to that meeting. And in that meeting, I hear these guys, this guy with 10 years, right? He had 10 years of sobriety. He was a stockbroker. This guy's used to trade stocks before the internet. And he was a stockbroker, and he was the best stockbroker in his brokerage. And they gave him a brand new Cadillac. And he left the brokerage that day and had 10 years of sobriety and figured, I got this licked. I got 10 years. I'm the best stockbroker there is at my brokerage. I have this brand new Cadillac. I can probably drink. Picked up a bottle of scotch, right? Goes home. Now, I'd just been reading the steps up on the wall, and I remember I got as far as step two. It's as far as I got. You know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could relieve us from this insanity. So this guy's talking about having 10 years, and he starts drinking scotch. And within like 2 weeks, he takes that brand new Cadillac, plows it into a telephone pole on purpose, so it'll have a good reason to call in sick and stay home and drink. And I think to myself, that dude's brilliant. He's insane. And then I look at the wall, and I'm like, uh-oh. That advanced day eight up there on the wall, it makes sense to me. They're talking to me. This is maybe this is advanced AA. And I've come to believe and I've come to know that if you're sitting in this room right now, welcome to advanced AA. Intermediate AA is sitting on the bar stool thinking about AA. When you get in here, you're in the advanced program. I also love it that like the most highest exalted position you can have in AA is sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? But that took me a while to figure out. Anyway, so I listened to this guy, and I went up and I talked to him after the meeting. I walk up, and I don't remember what I said. He said, hey, you want my number? And I was like, whoa, you know? I'm cool. And he's like, no. If you're thinking about drinking, but you don't want to, call me. And he gives me his phone number. And this other dude standing next to him named Andreas, he gives me his number as well. So now I've got these two numbers on a meeting schedule that I stole. I'm gonna backpedal a little bit here. When I called the central office that second time, the dude that answered the phone told me, he said, you know, you won't have to call me again if you go and you get yourself a meeting schedule. The meeting that I'm sending you to, there's gonna be this thing full of pamphlets, and one of them will say Greater Oakland Area Meeting Schedule. You can get that, then you don't have to call me. And I was like, cool. So I go into this meeting, I find that pamphlet thing, I see the meeting schedule, and I don't have any money, so I back up to it. Tuck it down the back of my pants. I got my schedule, right? So I'm writing this on my stolen schedule. I wasn't asking if it cost anything, you know, I just assumed. So I'm writing these phone numbers down, and they're writing their numbers down, and this is blowing my mind. I cannot believe that these guys who've known me for a total of 10 minutes, which is pretty much the total, you know, grand total of my sobriety at that point, and they're giving me their home phone numbers. Now, the culture I came from in New York, somebody does you a solid like that, you kind of owe them, right? You're not necessarily in their pocket, but they did you a solid, so you kind of gotta live up to it. And I felt that in those phone numbers. I felt that, you know? And that kept me sober for the first few weeks. The fact that these total strangers would give this other total stranger kid who was clearly a wreck their phone numbers, their home phone numbers, and say, call me if you don't feel like drinking. That meant so much to me. I never called them. But, you know, I don't know if I felt like drinking. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think I knew that you were allowed to drink again. I think once I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, by that time I had been in a gang, and so I knew what jumping into a gang was. And I figured 10 years of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization was a hell of a jump in, and I didn't really want to get jumped out of this club, you know? And I was, you know, I thank God for my craziness. I mean, I was just nuts. And I mean, I didn't know you could go out. I did not know. I thought you guys did a lot of dancing. They talk about, oh yeah, Eric, he went out. I think, wow, these guys go dancing a lot. I had no idea what was going on, and I wasn't asking any questions. Sponsorship, that was another great one. They're talking about sponsorship, and I'm thinking, you know, I know what a sponsor is. It's when you get really good at surfing or skating or whatever, right? You get the free t-shirts, You know, you get the stickers. Maybe they fly you somewhere and you get to do it there, you know? So I'm not going to get sponsored in AA for a long time because I'm brand new. So I'm not going to be good enough at this that I'm going to get the free books and t-shirts and, you know. So I'm not even going to broach that sponsoring question. I'm not going to debase myself by finding out how much I got to do to get sponsored, you know. So yeah, I went without a sponsor for the first 10 months of my sobriety. So these guys in Oakland, I'm going to tell a quick story. So the guy that answered the phone and told me where I could get a meeting schedule. Later in sobriety, I raced motorcycles, and I belonged to a motorcycle racing forum, a road racer. And there was an old dude on the forum, and he's an old pro racer, super cool. Actually, he's kind of a curmudgeon, but in a neat way, you know? And he would post things, and one day he posted something, and he said something, and I was like, oh, I think he's one of us, right? So I go in a private message him. I'm like, Ernie. And I tell him my quick story about how I got sober in Oakland in July 23rd, you know, 1999 and blah, blah, blah. And he just PMs me back. Yeah, Bo, I know. I was answering the phone that day. So, you know, be nice to people in AA. You never know where they're going to pop up in your life. So where was I? So these guys, they give me their phone numbers. So I go to the next meeting that they tell me to go to. And I go to that meeting. And after the meeting, they're like, hey, Bo, we're all going to go down to Gaylord's Coffee Shop, and we're going to play Scrabble. Why don't you come with us? And I'm like, nah, that's cool. And they're like, no, come with us. And I'm like, nah, I don't spell so good. I didn't graduate from high school, and it's not really my thing. And they're like, you don't have to do anything. Just come and sit down. And so I followed them. I'm like, sure. These guys are grinning, too. They're happy. You know, and somehow I knew, follow around the guys who are smiling the most. You know, and these dudes were just stoked. So I follow them to Gaylord's, and I'm sitting there, and they're playing Scrabble, and they're being wildly inappropriate, and everybody at the coffee shop kind of seems to know their deal, and everybody likes them, and they're just drinking coffee, and it's late at night, and they're spelling stuff that I've never even heard of, and I catch myself laughing. You know, I'm cracking up, and I cannot believe it. I am stone cold sober, and I'm laughing in the company of people that I almost feel comfortable with. You know, and I had no idea how to handle that. But I knew that this AA thing was doing something for me. So I don't ask these guys to sponsor me, but I follow them around to meetings for about 10 months before I got it. You know, I figure, yeah, at 23 or 33 days, I get asked to pitch a meeting in Berkeley. I'll never forget this. And I used it tonight. And I go to one of these guys, and I'm like, dude, what do I do? How do I tell my story? He said, Bo, you get out of the bathroom, you get on your knees, you say a prayer, then you come up there and you tell the truth. That's all there is to it. So tonight, that was my mantra. Say a prayer, tell the truth, you know? And that's where I learned that at, like, you know, my first 20 minutes of sobriety. So at 10 months, I figure I got it all figured out. And I love surfing, even though I was from the East Coast. But I came out to California, and Santa Cruz is the Mecca. So I'm like, I'm moving to Santa Cruz. By this time, I'm rolling in the coolest car ever, a 1976 Volvo 260 DL. It's copper. It's copper colored, you know. It fits 5 surfboards and that pistol, you know, which are pretty much everything I own. And my cat. I have a cat, right? Every good alcoholic guy's got a cat, right? So I moved to Santa Cruz. The guys in Oakland said, you know, be careful in Santa Cruz because the inmates run the prison there. And that's the last thing they tell me when I moved to Oakland. I still don't have a sponsor. I don't know what a sponsor is. But I go to a meeting, I hear some stuff, I watch this kid pick up a 30-day chip. And the next day I go to a young people's meeting because, you know, I can't stand the young people's meetings because I don't feel very young and I feel very out of place at a young people's meeting. But I've come to realize that uncomfort is where it's at. Like, comfort for me is that big plastic bottle of vodka and an easy chair and the TV set to shh, you know, that is comfort. So if I'm uncomfortable, I must be doing something right. So I go to this young people's meeting where I feel wildly out of place because they are so hip-slipping and cool. They just, you know, they got it all figured out. I have all this long blonde hair at the time and a crappy little goatee. I definitely don't look like I'm from Santa Cruz. But I show up at this meeting and that guy that I watched get a 30-day chip, they say they need a couple coffee people. And that guy raises his hand and says, I'll do it. And I got 10 months. And they say, okay, you can do it. We need another one. And I'm like, that guy's only got 30 days. I got 10 months. I could do this. They raise my hand and they make me the other coffee boy. So I show up at the meeting the next week and all of a sudden I belong. I belong there. I'm the coffee guy, right? The treasurer can run off with the money. You guys will find more money. You know, if the secretary doesn't show up, somebody will step up and be the secretary that night. If somebody doesn't show up and make the coffee, you guys are screwed. So I know I'm important, right? This is good. And I have a place there. So that's my pitch for service. Get into service. And I see this guy. He looks really, really funny at that meeting. He's got like the big, goofy, stretched ear things. Really bad tattoos. He's got a big old bald spot. He's probably about 8 or 10 years younger than me. He's got a grip of sobriety. He's got like 10 years at the time. And he's called upon to share, and he just seems so comfortable with himself, even though he looks really funny. And he's just so comfortable. And what he says makes a lot of sense to me. So after that meeting, by this time, I've asked somebody, what is a sponsor, right? And I was told, a sponsor is someone who shows you what's in the book so that you can show somebody else what's in the book. And that's all there is to it. So I go up to this guy and I say, hey, will you sponsor me? And he says, let me get back to you. So I find out years later that he went to his sponsor and he says, you know, hey, Tom, I just moved here from Sacramento and this guy asked me to sponsor him. I haven't really been here that long, so I think we should probably give him to somebody else, you know, before I haven't really lived here long enough. And his sponsor looks at him and says, Sean, it seems to me like you've learned how to do it, you know, do it yourself without giving it away, you know, that you found how to keep it without giving it away. Could you teach that to me so I don't have to sponsor you? I found this out years later. So my sponsor got goaded into sponsoring me, and we did the steps. I had no idea what we were doing when we did the steps. He'd have me read all the black parts of the book. And when we came to a step in the book, he'd go, dun, dun, dun. I do that now. And I did the steps. And I had a concept of what I was doing, but I really didn't understand what was going on. I did the 4-step. I don't know how rigorous it was. I know that it was honest. I did the best I could. We came to the 5th step. You know, we finished the 5th step. I went off for that half an hour where you sit and, you know, realize if the mortar that you used was good or whatever it says in the book. And I just felt like hammered crap, dude. You know, I had just read this. Yeah, my inventory. It was just, it took me years to realize that what I had read was who I am when I drink. That's what the inventory process did for me. Was it gave me an opportunity to look at who I am and who I don't have to be anymore. And so we did that inventory. I still didn't understand how that was going to change my life. And then we did 6 and 7, which I had no idea what was going on there. 8 and 9, I totally understood. And I was able to make some pretty good amends. 11, 12, no idea. But shortly thereafter, I began sponsoring guys. And that's how I learned the steps. Was sitting with other guys and teaching them the steps out of the book by rote. And that's how I learned, you know. That was teaching is what taught me the steps. I'll never forget sitting with this 19-year-old guy and reading him the 7th step, and all of a sudden it clicked on me exactly what the 7th step was. And that was just one of the gifts. So that's my pitch for sponsorship. I've been very lucky to sponsor. Well, we'll get into that. So I'm in Santa Cruz, and there are these guys who are the hippest, the slickest, and the coolest, just because, you know, it's my sponsor and these other few guys, and I just started following them around because they were the guys smiling the most, and they took me under their wing, and they all had like 10 or 12 years, and they were all a little bit younger than I am. I got sober at 32. I think they got sober at like 12. But they're super cool, and they take me under their wings. And we used to do seating by sobriety in cars, you know, so I was always sitting in the way back of whatever car we were in, you know. So I just started driving. You know, I'd be like, I got the Volvo. We can fit more people in it. So it was wonderful for me to watch Greg, who had 10 years, have to sit in the way back while I'm up there driving with, like, 18 months, you know. That's my I remember trying to pick up an 18-month chip. I said, I'm going to go get my 18-month chip. And my sponsor looks at me and goes, chip and a half. Winer's chip. I said, thanks, dude. Thanks, bro. I don't think I picked up another chip till I had 4 years. I had that kind of grudge. So I'm in Santa Cruz, and I meet her. And by this time, I've done a seventh step. So I'm not taking hostages anymore. And she and I get married, and she wants to start a business. I don't want to necessarily stay in Santa Cruz any longer. I was managing a fancy hotel in Palo Alto by then. And they did some research and found out that I had never graduated high school and fired me. They believed what I wrote on my resume. So I don't have a job, and it's December 21st. Anyway, long story short, we end up moving to San Luis Obispo. We get here to San Luis Obispo, and I don't really find a sponsor. I find a home group, that Friday Night Men's Stag. And I eventually find a sponsor, but I'm not really, you know, I sort of drift away from Alcoholics Anonymous. At this point, I had 7 years. Now I've got 8 years, and I'm drifting away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I come to that point of the reckoning. My whole life falls apart one day. I was a biker then, and I still sort of had that gang mentality. And without Alcoholics Anonymous, I lost my moral compass. And at this point, I still don't have a higher power. You know, I've got 8, 9 years, no higher power. And I'm not even knuckling it. I'd say I was struggling with higher power, but I wasn't even struggling. I wasn't doing anything about it. You know, it's just, you know, I didn't need one, it seemed. You know, I didn't do this prayer or meditation thing. And it seemed like it was working for me, and I drift away from Alcoholics Anonymous, and the next thing I know, I'm sleeping on a sponsee's couch. I'm kicked out of the house that I own more than the bank owns of, you know? And we have a brand new baby boy, and this woman has told me, you're out of here, you know? You're out of here. Because without Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that I'd never understood that sober horse thief thing until I lived it. And there I was with no moral compass and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, not doing AA and not with a higher power. And so I went back to my home group, and I went back with my tail between my legs, and I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go into my home group with my tail between my legs, and they don't see a guy with the tail between his legs. All they see is a guy that I haven't seen in weeks or months who's hurting. And they carry me through the next few months that I couldn't walk through. And one night I'm walking home from Farmer's Market. I was working at my wife's store at the time. And I'm walking home from Farmer's Market, and I pass the old Alana Club, and there are three guys sitting there, and they're like wet behind the ears sober. They're like months, you know, maybe a year. And they've got that stoke. You know, they're smiling. They're into AA. And I look at them, and I'm like, what meetings you guys go to? And they tell me, and I stalk them. I did. I stalked these three guys, man. I just went to all the meetings they went to. And one of them was the Wednesday night newcomer meeting at the Alana Club. And I went to that meeting. And by this time, I've got almost 10 years, and I have more time than anybody. And they need a secretary. And I'm like, I got this. I'll run for secretary. I run for secretary. They make me coffee boy. I do coffee boy for, I think, a year. And I would make the coffee strong and stronger. And I would label them. No decaf. And it was awesome. And I had a place in that meeting. Just like that young people's meeting, I belonged there, even on the days that I felt like I didn't belong. I'll never forget walking to the Jennifer Street Bridge in SLO. So I used to live in that neighborhood, and looking down at the Alano Club with all those people there on a Wednesday night, and having the overwhelming feeling of my people. These are my people. And so eventually they did make me the secretary of that meeting. And through all of that, I found a higher power, and I called him Huge. And I can't describe Huge to you other than to say it was the knowledge, that the faith, the belief that no matter what I was going through, as long as I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going to be okay. And that was it. And then, you know, in the morning I would get up and I'd say, Huge, get on my shoulders, ride me all, you know, right there, be there for me all day. So no matter what happens, I'm going to be okay. And I religiously started going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, which is what I used to do in Santa Cruz. I once went to a buddy of mine who's sitting in the audience tonight, and I said, dude, I think I got things pretty good right now. I had about 4 years. And I said, I'm going to cut back on my meetings. He said, yeah, don't do that. I said, why not? He said, because things aren't always going to be good. And you're going to need to be in the habit of going to meetings. And he was right. Because, you know, however many years, 6 years later, there I am going to meetings. So when stuff did happen, I was in the habit of going to meetings. I was in the habit of calling my sponsor. I was in the habit of picking up my phone when my sponsees call. I tell them to call me every day until I tell you not to, and I don't ever tell them not to. And when they call, I pick up the phone. And that's so I get used to picking up the phone. And it's so they get used to calling me. So when stuff happens, it's routine. And that has served me. So I have some great fortune happens in my life, some really good stuff business-wise. And I leave the little house in San Luis. And all of a sudden, like all my wildest dreams have come true. We have two sons by this time. And things are just fantastic. You know, they're greater than I ever thought that they'd ever be. You know, all the dreams come true. All the dreams came true for me, sort of at one point in my sobriety. This business thing happened, and just my life completely changes. Luckily, I had a role model for that sort of thing, and I was able to sort of keep it together and stay in AA and not really lose who I was through all of that. And the reason I bring that up is because shortly thereafter, I absolutely destroyed my life. I absolutely destroyed my life. I'm gonna share in a general way that You Suck voice had come back, but it had come back different. The You Suck voice had come back as sort of this internal dialogue of like, well, you're not getting this out of life. Well, you're not getting that. Well, you, and you should do this, and you should do that. And the You Suck voice is talking to me, and I start listening to it because I'm not, you know, I don't know what I'm not doing. I'm not listening to God. I'm listening to myself. You know, that internal chatter that you spoke about. It's going on. And the problem is I start listening to it. And I start to make decisions based on this internal dialogue that's lying to me. And through doing that, I cause just great harm to my own life. I can't even describe to you like the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that follows that. Except that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous and I was going to 4 or 5 meetings a week. So I knew what to do. Now, at about 17 and a half years, this happened 6 months ago, it's about 17 and a half years, I'm standing in a parking lot with 3 other alcoholic men right after a farmer's market, and this bum kid comes walking out from behind a dumpster, and he asks me for a cigarette. Somebody gives him a cigarette, and as he walks away, and he's just a mess, this poor kid, maybe 20 years old, and he's just a mess, talking to himself, you know, just gacked. And one of my sponsees looks at me and says, you know, 7 years ago, that was me. And I look at him, and I'm like, you know, now you're a responsible single father. You own your own business. You pay your rent. You do steps. You call your sponsor every day. What happened? And he looks at me like I'm an idiot. He's like, God? Now, realize I have a higher power, but I still don't believe in God. So that night I get in my truck and I'm driving down Pismo Street. And then it hits me, right? And I look up on my headliner and there's God. And God came to me in that sort of burning bush. And the overwhelming realization that God had always been there for me and was just waiting for me to figure it out. You know, like, hey, bro, I'm here. Always been here. And that was huge because fast forward, you know, several months later, I torch my life. But now I've got God. And so I have something to lean on. And I have Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go to meetings that I don't like to go to. You know, I start going to morning meetings that, you know, the morning melody. And one morning I'm at Melody, I'm just dying. I'm having that minute to minute. How am I not, you know? Previously that evening, the evening before, I'd been in the closet and I'm thinking to myself, there's a gun right there. I could just end this right now. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, you'll stand here. And I was like, oh geez, you'll have to shoot yourself with your left hand so that your brains go onto her clothes, not onto yours, right? You guys are laughing. Try and tell a bunch of earth people that joke, right? It's not even a joke. It really happened, right? They're going to 5150 you. You guys laugh. This is why I love you. So that's what I'm thinking the night before. So I go to this meeting, and it's minute to minute, and I'm just dying. I'm absolutely dying. And we read this part in the book that just makes me so angry. You know, it's about how we should not pray for our own selfish ends. unless it will serve others. And I'm like, why do I gotta have that caveat? Right now, I need God to take care of me. Now, forget others. I just need to make it to the next minute. And I articulate this when it comes my turn to share. And I put my head in my hands. And I'm just sure I'm just going to die in that moment. And Rebecca walks over and kisses me on the forehead. And that moment, I knew I was going to make it. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous. Where else does that happen? You know? And then she shares and agrees with me, which was pretty awesome. But that, you know, anyway. So I leave that meeting and I realize I'm going to make it that day. More stuff happens. One night on a Tuesday night, I'm at home. And some terrible stuff happens, some really terrible stuff. And I'm thinking about my wife's an earth person, and I'm thinking about the bottles of wine that are in the house. And I'm thinking there's red and white, and I want to drink a whole bottle of wine in one pull. Do I go red? It's got the tannins, it's probably going to make me stuffy in my nose, right? But the white, unless it's cold, is going to go down kind of sharp. It's going to kind of hurt. Like, which one of those am I going to drink? Because there's none in the fridge. I'm thinking these things with 19 years of sobriety. So I text a dude at a meeting who's sitting in this meeting. And he's at a meeting that I usually go to, but I didn't go to that night. And I said, I need you guys to be there after the meeting. And I get in my truck and I drive to the Alana Club on this cold, wet night. And I pull into the parking lot and there are five guys standing there in the parking lot 30 minutes after the meeting. And they're standing there for me because I'm hurting, because I reached out for help. And they saved my life that night. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's, where else does that happen? I think about how we say we're so grateful for AA, and that word gratitude, that word grateful, it's not big enough to wrap around what I have for this. You know, without this, I'm dead, or worse, I'm alive. Worse. So, I make it through that part of my life. And in that part, and I find God, and I actually come out of it. I come out of it a better person, with a real understanding for Alcoholics Anonymous and for who I am. And I have a deep, deep understanding of the sponsor-sponsee relationship at that point. I'm going to wrap this up very quickly. I call my sponsor when all this stuff goes down, and I tell him what's going on, and I'm crying, and he has me, and he says, "That's great, Bo. That's great, Bo. You've got 100 shoulders to cry on. Mine's not one of them. Go get your book." Right? That's a sponsor I have now. And we do, you know, and I do the work. And I did what Alcoholics Anonymous told me to do. I remember reading in Living Sober that it said Alcoholics Anonymous has the answer to all your questions and all your problems. And what I didn't realize, and I thought, no, that's impossible. What I didn't realize was sometimes Alcoholics Anonymous tells you to look for outside help. So I get myself a therapist. And that does wonders for me, for not only my sobriety, but for my spirituality. And I make it through that really tough part of my life. And I come out a better person, and I wouldn't trade what happened for anything. And so here I am tonight, pitching this meeting, still nervous. And I'm looking out at all of you, and like, how many of you have touched my life? And I'll close with this. I believe there's a simple cure for the alcohol, simple cure for alcoholism. And it's the ability to ask for help. The humility to ask for help. You know, if you're in AA, no matter what, if you ask for help, you're going to be okay. I mean, I'm living proof of that. If you can be humble enough to ask for help. Thank you very much. Yeah.